Yeah, last week we started a series on the non-Jew in the home, and we, in the first few minutes of last week, we already discovered that there's at least six topics that we need to figure out when we're dealing with a non-Jew being in a Jewish home. So last week we spoke about yichud, that very often if there's a housekeeper in the house, that you end up in a difficult situation of yichud because parents aren't home and you are home. So we discuss possible solutions or ways around or what the possible potential heterim and isurim are of the issue yichud. This week I want to talk about bishul akum. What if a guy is doing the cooking? I mentioned last week that every once in a while in high school where we teach, someone will come to light that a boy will raise his hand. Wait a second, there's such a thing as bishul akum? My housekeeper cooks all of our dinners every single night. What do you mean bishul akum? So every once in a while, someone's unaware of this prohibition, and really it's a simple fix. If you're Ashkenazic, it's a fairly simple fix, and it's important to be somewhat familiar with the halachas of bishul akum. So first of all, let's start with the basics. When it comes to any isser, any avera, anything you're not allowed to do, first question you have to ask: are we dealing with an isser d'oraisa or are we dealing with an isser d'rabanan? So what are we dealing with over here, d'oraisa or d'rabanan? D'rabanan. Bishul akum is an isser d'rabanan. Tosus points out that the Gemara seems to have an assumption at first. Not seems, the Gemara really has an assumption at first that it must be Doraisa. Then the Gemara says, no, it's not really Doraisa, it's not really based on the Pasuk, it's Drabanan. So the Gemara very clearly concludes that it's Drabanan, but from the fact that the Gemara has this kind of conversation, where it sounds like, where would the Gemara be? Bishul akum. So from the fact that the Gemara has this conversation about bishul akum, Tosfos points out, leads you to believe that it's a very, very early din d'rabanan. There are some dinim d'rabanan that were instituted later. Bishul akum must have been a very, very early din mid'rabanan. Why is bishul akum asur? I mean, the rabbis made it up, so they made it up for a reason. What was the reason that they said you shouldn't eat food cooked by a non-Jew? Intermarriage is one possibility. It's the other possibility. They could put something in the food. Those are the two possibilities. They might stick some non-kosher food into your food, or it may be a concern that you're going to be so enamored with their food. It's going to be so delicious, you're going to say, wow, I'd love to have this food all the time. You know, it would be a great way to have this food all the time if I was part of your family. Then I'd always be invited for Thanksgiving dinner, and I would be able to have this food all the time. So those are the two possibilities. Rashi really writes both of them in Maseches Avodah Zarah, and both of them are true. And we'll see that sometimes one of the concerns may apply and the other one may not. Sometimes neither of them may apply. How many exceptions are there to the rule? Meaning, is it also for a guy to cook anything? I go into, I'm driving on a long road trip somewhere, and I pull into a stop, you know, along the highway on the New Jersey Turnpike or something, and I find a place that sells coffee. But they don't have a Jewish mashgiach there cooking the coffee. So I'm allowed to buy the coffee, or I'm not allowed to buy the coffee. So the general assumption, leaving out all kashrus issues, assuming that it's just plain coffee, and they don't wash the coffee pot with any ham sandwich utensils or anything like that. Just assuming it's just straight coffee, it's not a problem with bishul akum. Well, why not? Well, what are the exceptions to the rule?
It can't be on a clean table.
So one of the Gemara actually has three exceptions to the rule. So one of the exceptions the Gemara has is that bishul akum, they were only goes with bishul akum and that which is olal shulchan malachim, that which will go on a king's table, meaning it's a really dignified kind of food. It's not just some low class type of food. What else? That's not the heter for coffee. That's an interesting idea that the coffee is roasted. It's tzli. It's not bishul. What else? What? There actually is such a thing as non-kosher coffee. There are all sorts of flavors that they could put into coffee. And plain coffee is always kosher. But there are all sorts of flavors that they could put into coffee. A lot of times people assume that, you know, you go to a coffee shop and they, you know, there's a place in the Five Towns, the cheese store. So the cheese store doesn't have any ashkacha, but they put on their sign outside the cheese store, they write an OU on the sign. I don't know why the OU hasn't sued them yet, but they write an OU on the sign to let you know that all their coffees are under the OU. It could be that the flavors that they put in their coffee that the bottle has an OU on it, but you're certainly not allowed to trust them that that's the case. If you ask them, can I see the bottle that you're using to spritz into the coffee? Because did you know that flavoring coffees is not really a very fancy process? It's not like you think they roast the beans with the flavors. That very, very rarely. Usually what it means is they make a coffee and they spritz in a little flavor. And that's the whole process. So if you buy a regular coffee and you ask them to see the spritz and the spritz has an OU, so then you can trust them. But short of that, I don't think you can. What? Plain coffee, maybe. I don't see even need. This is really beyond our topic. The short answer is no. I've been told that someone told me they were getting a coffee there, and an elderly religious couple walked in, and they started buying cheese. And someone said to them, you know, cheese isn't kosher. They said, what are you talking about? All the from people come here. So it could be a Five Towns mentality that if the whole store isn't kosher, people are so used to the whole store being kosher, every supermarket and butcher, everything, the whole thing is kosher. But it's really a different topic about ne'amanus and who you can believe for kashrus, who you can't. Well, let's try to bring it back to Bishlachim. Okay. You're not going to bring it back to Bishlachim. Yeah?
Would the cheese fall under
Let's talk about Chol Yisrael a different time, okay? Let's stick with Bishlachim for now. So we have one heter is that something that's a low-class kind of food. We're not be Ola al Shulchan Malachim. One is allowed to have a non-Jew cook, and that would not be a problem if a non-Jew cooks something that's not Ola al Shulchan Malachim. That's a difficult heter to apply, because how do you define exactly what's considered to be Ola al Shulchan Malachim, what would go on a king's table? Is it that the king would never eat such a thing because he'd be like, this is gross, I'm a classy person, I would never eat it? Or is it that they would never put it on the White House menu for a state dinner? I think generally most of the kosher agencies are makel that it would be something that would call the White House and say, would this ever be on the menu for a state dinner? This is one of those rare halachos that, not so rare, that the halacha changes over time. There are most of Torah, we believe, the Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai, given to all of Klal Yisrael, and it hasn't really changed. But there are certain halachos that over time changes, because not because the halacha changes, but because the halacha is based on a definition and the way society defines something changes. So the halacha is that which a king wouldn't eat. Well, maybe something, you know, I remember when I was younger, mashed potatoes was like slop. It was like what you'd see in the movies when someone joined the army and there was nothing to eat. So they would show, the scene would be of a plate with slop, mashed potatoes. And it's like, oh, I used to eat so well and now I'm eating mashed potatoes. And then around the time I was getting married, it became very, very popular at weddings to have mashed potatoes at weddings, which was very exciting for me because it was a food I recognized, which wasn't always the case at weddings. So it was so that they were serving mashed potatoes at weddings. So that means it was Olal Shulchan Malachim at that point if they would serve it at a wedding. So this is one of those halachas that could change. But yeah, what else?
Yeah, so what is the fact that it wouldn't be on a king's table? How does that permit it with the two reasons that you
have? Very good. So how does that fit with the reasons? So in terms of the reason that he might stick something non-kosher, it doesn't really seem to fit, but it fits very nicely with the other reason, that you're going to be so enamored with him, that you're so in love with this food, that you're going to come to marry his daughter. Well, that's not likely to happen if what you're eating is such an undignified food that a dignified person doesn't eat, or that it's not such a fancy food. So, you know, oh, he served me. I remember one of my Talmidim got married. I said, how's it going? Oh, my wife is the best. She served Cheerios and milk for dinner once, and he was so excited. Like, I wasn't Cheerios and milk, but it was something like that. Like, oh, it was the biggest deal. Great, you should always view it like that. But most people aren't going to be so excited about the fact that they have Cheerios and milk. So that's one hetzer so far. We only got one so far. What else do we have? Oh, so I wouldn't even call that a heter. I would call that as the guy didn't really do the cooking. Meaning that we're going to have to define how much cooking does the guy have to do for it to be called that the guy did the cooking. So we'll get to that. But let's go through the three heterim first. Heter number two, or really number one, the first one the Gemara mentions, is something that's ne'achal kemoshu hu chai. Something that's edible raw is not subject to bishalakum. And here's another halacha that can change over time. A couple of weeks ago, I gave a shiur in my shul about halachas that change over time, that the halacha doesn't stay the same. I called it neo-reform. halacha that changes over time. So I came up with 9 examples of halachas that change over time, and someone sent me an email that I thought of a few more, person wrote, and then there was a list of 35 examples. And the person wasn't actually informed. Those were actually real, really true halachas that change over time. So this is another one. What's considered to be edible raw? When I was growing up, to eat raw fish in the United States of America was not done. It was disgusting. No one would eat raw fish in the United States of America. Nowadays, everybody eats raw fish. We all eat salmon, as long as you wrap a little rice and seaweed around it. People eat raw salmon and raw tuna and all sorts of raw fish. So would that mean that these things are now considered no longer subject to bishul akum? Would that mean that your housekeeper now can cook you a whole side of salmon? Would that make it mutter? So that's also a discussion. How exactly do we define what's considered edible raw? Would you eat a full fillet of salmon raw? I wouldn't. There are people that eat, what do they call it, sashimi? Something like, where they're eating literally just slices of raw fish, right? That's what it is. It's just slices of raw fish, even if not mixed with anything else. And as that becomes more popular and that becomes a normal thing to do, so this halacha is likely shifting, where salmon is likely moving very close to not being subject to bishul akum. Tuna fish was a huge controversy in terms of the bishul akum issues related to tuna fish, how they would cook them in the cans. So the OU was makel for many years about the tuna fish, with a few different reasons to be makel. One is that it's canned food. What king in his right mind would ever eat canned food? Certainly not at a state dinner. And they used the heter that people could eat tuna raw. And certainly nowadays, it's becoming much more popular to eat tuna raw. And they had another idea that it wasn't cooked in the normal fashion. It was steam cooked, which maybe is different than regular cooking. But they used all of these different snif from lahako. They used all of these kulas. So that is another heter. So far we have olal shulchan malachim nechul kamo shulchai. There's a third heter that's probably the least known of all of them, and that because it's the least common. And that is that if the guy has no intention to cook, he's not trying to cook. The guy is an arsonist. He lights things on fire. So he's committing arson. He's burning a person's house down. Guess what? In the house, there was some raw meat. So everything was destroyed, except the meat was improved. It's now cooked. So now you have barbecued meat and the whole house that's burnt down. So, it's a small hatzala porta that you go and you check everything. And can you eat the meat? So the halacha is yes, the Gemara says, that if he burns a whole swamp and there are some grasshoppers in the swamp that get singed to perfection, you're allowed to, assuming they're kosher, you're allowed to eat them. Or if you burn the hair off of the animal's head, so you're just trying to burn the hair off of the head, and it singes the tips of the ears, so the ears are delicious now, so you're allowed to eat it because he wasn't. See, when does this ever come up, that a guy's not intending to cook? So I'll tell you a story. Rabbi Shmuel Marcus, a friend of mine, told me this maisa happened in Toronto. There was a Talmud Chacham in Toronto named Rav Shlomo Miller. He's Rosh Kollel in Toronto, big posek in the Lakewood community. So apparently there was a Sheva Brachos at someone's house, and they were having like 100 guests for Shabbos, and the Cholent was in this massive crock pot, and they realized during Ben HaShemashos, after Shkia, after sunset on Friday night, that no one ever plugged in the crock pot. What do you do? No one ever plugged in the crock pot. So what? You'll ask a guy, it's been a shmashos, ask a guy to plug in the crock pot, such a major tzorech, maybe you could do that. What's going to be the problem if you ask a guy to plug in the crock pot? It's bishul akum. The guy's going to be cooking. Everything's raw right now. And it's all shulchan malachim. Somebody they're going to serve on a shavuot brachos. So you can ask the guy to plug in the crock pot, not so good. So Shlomo Miller, without thinking for a second, said, oh, it's simple. You have two guys around. Get one guy to shut off all the power in the house. Don't tell him why. While the power's off, have another guy plug in the crock pot. And then have the first guy who shut off the power turn all the power in the house back on. He said, then it's no problem. It's not a problem with bishul akum. Why is turning all the power in the house back on going to help? Because he's not cooking. You ask him, what are you doing? He's not going to say, oh, I'm cooking what's in the crock pot over there. He's going to say, I'm turning the power on in the house. It happens to be when he turns the power on in the house, there's going to be some power that goes to the crock pot. It's going to cook everything in the crock pot. Fantastic, you solve all the world's problems. So right, just like that. So it's important to know the halachas, even the ones that aren't really so relevant, because you never know. You never know when it's going to come in handy, when you're going to be in a Rosh Shlomo Miller situation where you have to answer that kind of shayla. I was very blown away by that on the spot that he immediately applied that halacha. So that's a third exception that's in the Gemara. So those are the three exceptions. You had a question before?
No.
So those are the three basic exceptions that you have in the Gemara. Are there any other exceptions that maybe the Gemara didn't tell us about? So Rishonim discuss another possible exception. Tosos quotes two different opinions about maybe if you're in the home of a Jew, maybe that makes it better. The fact that you're in a Jewish home, why would it make it better if you're in a Jewish home? So, yeah? But it's still a guy, so why is it, you're right, but why is there no fear of intermarriage just because they're working in your home?
I guess the assumption is that in your house.
What kind of guy is working in your house? Is it the kind of guy that you're likely to intermarry?
No.
You look at them as they're an employee, they're used to be a servant or something like that. That's not the kind of person that you would intermarry. I mean, hopefully you wouldn't intermarry anyone, but it's not the kind of person that would be at all enticing. It's one thing, your boss at work or something like that, but this is someone who's a servant. So chasnus luchora would not be as relevant to a servant. And what about the other concern, that he might feed you something not kosher? Oh, we'll get to it in a second. So, what?
There's more supervision,
and all the food available is kosher. You only shop at, now, not all the food is milchigs or fleishigs. That could easily be mixed together. But at least all the food available is kosher, and there's more supervision. So is this good? Can we rely on this?
Yeah. Shkiah doesn't always have to be.
But so we'll get to it in a second. How much the mashgiach has to do? How much the Jew has to do in the cooking in order to?
You can just say you can act as a mashgiach, but you have to
come. Okay, but it's more. That would be in terms of non-kosher, but in terms of bishalakum, you need to do more than that. And we'll see what they do in restaurants in a moment. So going back to this heter. So in a Jewish home, should we just say that's fine? So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Kuf Yud Gimel in Yerodeah Siv Dalid. Yesh mi shematir b'shvachu shalanu v'yesh mi she'oser. Some say it's mutter, some say it's aser, v'afil b'diavad. And those that say it's aser, even it's aser b'diavad. I mean, even if a guy already did it, you're still not allowed to eat the food. And then the Ramah says, and it sounds so promising when the Ramah starts out, he says, v'diavad yesh lismocha divrei matirim, that b'diavad, if it was already done, b'davad, it was already happened, you're allowed to rely on those who are lenient, which would mean you come home and the housekeeper didn't realize she's not allowed to cook, but she did. It sounds like he's saying, no problem to eat it, but then you got to read a little further. And he says, "Va'filu l'charchila no'agin l'hakel b'beis Yisrael. Even l'charchila our minhag is to be lenient. Sha'ashvachos va'avadim mevashlim b'beis Yisrael, ki I efshar shalo yichata echad mibnei habayis ma'at." And the Ramah says, you know why? Because probably one of the Jews went and did something with the food while it was cooking. There's no way that someone's cooking, a non-Jew is cooking in a Jewish home, and not a single one of the Jewish people in the home went to do something, to stir the pot, to stoke the coals, to do something with it, to raise the flame, to lower the, do something with it to make it cook better. So since a Jew participated in the process, probably, in all likelihood, a Jew participated in the process, that's what makes it mutter. So the impression you get from the Ramah is only if that's a reasonable possibility, that a Jew participated in the process. But if a Jew didn't participate in the process, then we shouldn't rely on it. Poskim adayom debate how much we can use this heter. We can use this shita and rishonim in a Jewish home. I was once sitting in the DRS-based medrash, and Rav Schechter happened to have been there, and he was giving it, they used to have a branch of the YU Kolel, of Rav Schechter's Kolel, learning DRS every afternoon. So Rav Schechter came, it was supposed to be once a month, and it was once, 6 years, but it was once that he came and gave a shir. And once he was there, we took advantage, like he's often taken advantage of, and he said shir nonstop to this group, that group, that group. So we were in the middle of shir, and someone comes running in from the office. Rabbi Schechter, you have a phone call. Well, what happened? So apparently there was a very prominent family, a very wealthy family, whose name you know. Their name is probably on the front of many of your Gemaras, and they were making a Shevar Brachas in Ohio, and they realized that someone had that a non-Jew had something got unplugged or whatever, and non-Jew ended up cooking everything for the Shevar Brachas. So they didn't know what to do, and it's like it starts in 5 minutes. Like, what do we do now? So in that situation, he was willing to be lenient, to be somech on those opinions that say in a Jewish home, the Aved, that that we could rely on that. Different poskim are makel to different extents with this. It's at least a what we call a sniff lahakel. When you have other reasons to be lenient, we'll sometimes be lenient with that. Yeah.
What's considered the process?
Ah, so this is most important and most relevant. What's considered a Jew participating in the cooking process? So here it's different if you're Sephardic versus if you are Ashkenazi. For an Ashkenazi Jew, the Ramah paskins that any sort of participation whatsoever, including raising the flame, turning on the flame, is enough. You don't need to actually put the food on the fire. You turned on the fire, and that fire cooked the food. That's good enough. So that's what they do in most restaurants. They'll have a mashkiach turn on the fire. I believe the OU now has a system where they can even do this in factories by a computer, where they can go on, log on in the OU office, and type in a thing, and fire turns on in some factory in wherever in Middle America, and they're able to turn on the fire remotely in that way. But if a Jew turns on the fire, so a Jew is considered to be participating in the cooking process. For a Sephardic Jew, it's not enough that that you turn on the fire. For a Sephardic Jew, the Shulchan Aruch says kol shebishlo Yisrael ma'at bishulam. If a Jew participated in the cooking, whether it's the beginning or the end, it's mutter, but it has to be part of the bishul itself, part of the cooking itself. Turning on a fire when there's no food on it is not really cooking. Turning on a fire when there is food on it is cooking, but when there's no food on it, it's not cooking. Now, a lot of people make the mistake. They think, oh, a Jew only needs to participate a little bit. If you're an Ashkenazi person, you only need to participate a little bit. So I'll prepare all the food. I'll put it all in a pot. Then I'll take all this raw food that's in a pot, put it in the fridge, and all I'll ask the non-Jewish housekeeper to do is turn on the fire, turn on the oven, take the pot out of the fridge, and put it in the oven. That is not okay. Why is that not okay?
You didn't do any of the cooking.
You did preparing, which is nice. It's like peeling the potatoes. But you didn't do any of the cooking. The cooking is defined as taking raw food and putting it in contact with heat. And making that. If you didn't put it in contact with heat, then you didn't do any of the cooking. Yeah.
What if the
Yeah, so if that's... So that's a participation. That's a participation. If the guy turned the flame off...
Let's say you turn on the flame, so you're fine.
Right.
He has to use the flame in order to cook also. So let's say he turns it off by accident.
And then he just quickly turns it back on. So I had this problem. I was at a hotel on Pesach. There are all sorts of interesting things that come up in hotels on Pesach. I have a friend whose father ran programs in hotels for many years, and he said, I could tell you after running programs in hotels, 80% of the hotels are kosher. And 50% are kosher LePesach. So, but they had an omelet station, and so every once in a while the fire would go out. Now it wasn't a concern to me because I would never eat at an omelet station because there's a line. Like I have a policy, I don't wait online for food. So there was a line at the omelet. So the fire would go out. So the guy would just take a match and relight the fire. That's not okay. If he's relighting the fire now, if you turned on the fire and you started the cooking, and then the fire went out, so then it would depend how cooked the food got. If the food didn't get to machal ben drusai, didn't even get to barely edible, so then the food is considered raw. So the guy is taking raw food and he's cooking it for you. But once the food got to machal ben drusai, Shulchan Aruch says, so then it's considered that it's already cooked food, and you participated in that cooking, and the guy, you know, turning the fire back on would be fine. If a Jew does the cooking, a guy could turn on the fire. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
for a Sephardi Jew, it would have to be that he'd have to put the food on the fire or something like that. He'd have to actually help with the... He doesn't have to turn on the fire if he's going to help with the cooking. Right, he doesn't have to turn on the fire. I remember years ago we had my Talmidim over, 11th grade Talmidim over for a Friday night, and it was when we had a non-Jewish help in the house. And my wife was making chicken cutlets, so she was, and it used to be, back in the day when we were young enough to still fry chicken cutlets without worrying about becoming morbidly obese. So my wife was frying chicken cutlets, so she turned on the fire and she had the oil going and she was breading all the chicken. And the housekeeper was taking the cutlets and just throwing them in the pan. My wife was right there and she had turned on the fire. But then we realized I had like 6 Sephardic students in the class that year. So I wasn't so poshut for the Sephardic students. In general, for Sephardim, it's not so poshut. There are tshuvas written by great Sephardic poskim about how a Sephardi can learn in Ashkenazi yeshiva that rely on all these bishalakim in the kitchen, all these bishalakim issues. How a Sephardi person can go to restaurants. All of these things that in chasnas and everything else without a Sephardi ashkacha that lives up to those standards. It's not such a simple issue. But a Jew has to participate in for an Ashkenazi person, even minimal participation. So the eitzah that most people do is you turn on the fire for the if the guy needs to cook for whatever reason, you turn on the fire. Now what about the kalim? The guy already cooked. So are the kalim treif? So really the lumdus over here is what's bishalakum? Is it that it becomes like macholos asuros? It becomes like it's like pig now? It's like in which case it treifs up the kalim? Or it's a gezeira that you shouldn't do this, but it's not that it becomes macholos asuros. So it's machlokas rishon. Both opinions are quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Yud Gimel in Shulchan Aruch, and the Shulchan Aruch, based on the rules that the Shulchan Aruch normally uses to paskin, it sounds like he's machmir. It sounds like he'll let the kalim become a problem. So this is where that idea that in a Jewish home can come in handy, because if let's say it's a kli that's impossible to kasher. And the guy cooked in that kli, and it's an expensive kli, Zeftin Rub or something like that. It's not easy to just kasher the kli. So in that kind of situation, a rabbi might be willing to rely on the fact that there's one opinion in Shulchan Aruch that says that it's not going to ruin the kelim anyway. And even if it is going to ruin the kelim, but it's in a Jewish home, so maybe that combination of factors, there's what to rely on. I know Rav Chaim Kanievsky, 2 of my friends told me, they asked Rav Chaim Kanievsky about this, and he was willing to rely on that. Even for the food, he thought that if it was in a Beis Hashem Yisrael and the guy cooked, that you're even allowed to eat the food. But vaday for the kelim, he thought you could rely on it. I think the minhag of most poskim in America is definitely not to rely on it for the food, and there's very good reason for that. When you tell the non-Jews working in your house, you know, listen, we're very strict about our standards for cooking and what you can cook and what kind of food you can bring in. And then the first time she makes a mistake, you say, "Oh, no big deal, let's have dinner." The impression that she will get is that it's no big deal, that this religion thing is not—it's not really that important to you. Much better to make a show of it that you're throwing out the food, you're throwing out the pot, and look what you did. I have to get to realize just how serious this is. That she should much better is not to have a cook at all. She shouldn't be cooking anything. But assuming that's not workable for whatever reason, so you at least have to make a big statement about it. I just don't want to delay mincha for you, but I'm happy to take questions.
How old do you have to be to do this?
So a Jew is even a very young Jew.